Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire!
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel, we are energizing transporter beam. Now!
Hello, welcome everybody to Star Trek From the Holodeck, the Discovery Edition. I am Michael Flores, your host, and at the helm with me in the studio today is David. Hello, Dave.
That sounded like you needed a mind meld.
Yeah. I told you today's show is going to be difficult for me. We're recording on an off day. I'm all thrown off. And when that happens, Dave, that means I babble and I don't make a lot of sense.
Just like what happened in this discovery.
Oh, look at you, David, drawing those parallels there. Good job. I wasn't even going in that direction, but maybe subconsciously I was. I like it. All right, so we're going to be talking about Season 2, Episode 4, Abel for Karen, directed by Lee Rose, written by Alan B. McElroy and Andrew Covell. All right, so I'm digging the hell. I'm really digging the pacing, the hell out of the pacing for this season so far.
It feels so different from season one.
I mean, we are only 4 episodes in, and it feels like a lot has transpired. There are a lot of moving parts to this season's narrative, but I like that you can see what they're working toward. And not that it is, and I'm not saying it's predictable, but we've got that clear path. We always talk about that. What is the path? Where is the story going? What is the story? Most audiences need to know. I'm sorry. When you're writing a TV show, not most audiences or most TV shows, when you are writing a TV show, you have got to let your audience know what the story is going to be about. We don't have all the answers, of course, but we know what the story is. We can pinpoint this season's myth arc and comparatively, look at last season. What was the myth arc? Burnham's redemption? Mirror universe Lorca's puppeteering of events and manipulation? The Klingon war? I mean, what? Your guess is as good as mine,
yeah,
Dave.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, it was so all over the place. We don't really know, and we're not having that issue. We know what this season's story is about, what the myth arc is. And in retrospect, you can say that the myth arc for last season was all of that from Burnham's perspective. Yes, you can say that. They wanted to focus to be on her and to be more of an intimate Star Trek series.
This feels more intimate than season one.
Yes.
I'll be honest. I mean, like the whole myth arc this season, if they wanted to actually get really personal with Burnham, they've done it more in this season, in these 4 right. episodes. Than they did in second season, because like everything seems to actually, even like the character development from other characters seem to intertwine with Burnham's story so perfectly. And it helps Burnham go along and kind of Burnham is learning even more than what she's been learning in season one.
Yeah, this season is doing. They're staying true to the core concept of Discovery, which is a show that's focused on Burnham. It's supposed to be one character centric. That was the whole thing, right? From the very beginnings of the promotions for the Star Trek Discovery, they said that this is going to be a show about a lieutenant and not necessarily about the captain. But that even that concept was a little murky last year. This season appears to have a better grasp on that concept. Season 2 is about Burnham, and I'd say 90% of the episodes are from her perspective. But what is different is how Kurtzman and his staff are letting the story unravel this season. It's better suited for that type of concept.
Yes.
Essentially having Spock as a bit of a MacGuffin at the center of not only the main myth arc, but also intrinsically tied to Burnham's own development as a character And by doing that, it's just really aided with this type of story, with the ideas that they're trying to use, or I should say the style of writing that they're trying to use for this series. And it's obvious that Kurtzman analyzed the entirety of season one and he recognized the narrative issues. And now it's all about course correcting and making sure that the core concept of the show evolves to being exactly what it probably was meant to be last season. And the narrative is, of course, not only the thing he's focusing on fixing, as we've discussed numerous times this season, but he's also bringing the crew into the show a lot more. And he's working on fixing some continuity issues.
Far more, because like, if you think about it, by the end of season one, it was amazing to me that one of the biggest scenes in season two that we all talked about, that basically was really one of the greatest scenes by far, was Pike making everyone tell us their names. And it didn't dawn on me that basically
we didn't know their names.
We didn't know their names in season one. And I was like going, well, wait a minute. Yeah. All these characters look great. They looked interesting. Did I really know their name? No, we never really got to know the crew of Discovery.
Yeah. And like all Star Trek fans, Dave, we're always looking ahead. Even though we have the immediate season, we're always thinking about what's next. What's around the corner?
We're not
easily satisfied. We always want more, right? And honestly, at this rate, if they keep going in this direction and they keep the shows grounded and they're focusing on the development of our characters and really stressing the importance of maintaining a clear path that is our myth arc, at this rate, season three is going to be fantastic. If Kurtzman is able to bring this boat around completely, the subsequent seasons will be a force to reckon with. Guaranteed.
And on top of that, Kurtzman's been able to actually, with his writing team, within four episodes, answer a ton of plot holes that we had from season one.
And Dave, isn't this something we've been saying since last season? Everybody calm down. When we were defending the show from trolls, like, oh, they're fucking this up and they're messing up continuity. And even last season, the showrunners, Aaron Herberts and Gretchen Berg, they were saying, hey, you know what? We're telling a story, guys. We're not just ignoring continuity or canon. We will rectify and get there eventually. And Kurtzman is living by their promise. You know, even though he's not the one that made that promise, he's making sure that that comes to reality. And he knows that he needed to, because he wouldn't have a career when it comes to Star Trek if he continued to disrupt continuity without any clear fixing.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's very obvious that they are trying to course correct, I think a lot of us can just kind of relax now and realize any big continuity issues are going to be resolved. I think people just need to sit tight and wait. If they weren't even, let's say we're four episodes in and there hasn't been any explanation about anything yet or any fixes, then all right, I might be with you guys and let's worry a little bit that they're just going to continue to ignore them. But no, they're dealing with them four episodes in and they have managed to rectify various things. But
they're not stumbling over their explanations. That's
not at all.
It's fucking easy.
It's simple.
But, like, all the plot hole. It was amazing this episode watching them cover up one of the biggest plot holes, which I'm not sure if we should talk about, but like one of the biggest plot holes that everyone constantly talked about the Enterprise and Discovery, the difference in both ships. And in one scene, he uses Pike, one bit of dialogue cleared everything.
Yeah.
And I'm like going, oh my God, he did it without actually even blinking.
Yeah. And we'll get to that, because that's a big part of this week's episode discussion. But most importantly, Dave, the one thing that they're focusing on more than anything is our crew. That's something that's a must. We need our crew. That was one of the biggest issues with season one that I really didn't harp on last year, because I understood what they were trying to do.
Uh-huh.
Season one and Star Trek Discovery essentially being a Burnham story. The story is about her. So I didn't really harp on it. But this year, how they are bringing the crew in as we need them is exactly how it should have been. either pair Burnham up with a new character each week or write a parallel narrative that works in tandem with the main story, which allows the writers to develop our crew. And that's exactly what they've done so far this season. This episode alone, they really spent a lot of time with Saru, but we also got more on Tilly, Stamets, and of course, my favorite newcomer, Jet Reno.
Yeah.
They really shared the spotlight this week without deviating from the main story or without forgetting that essentially this is a story from Burnham's perspective. And of course, there were people complaining about the lack of character development in the show. And I just threw my hands up in the air after I saw this tweet from a very reputable Star Trek blogger. And honestly, dude, I hope he loses his reputation because I don't know how this guy even managed to get to the reputable status, because this guy obviously doesn't understand Star Trek as much as he likes to think he does.
Yeah.
And this was the same loser that was talking about the alleged absence of violence in previous iterations of Trek. I went into that last week, right? I talked about that. But he's talking about the lack of character development. And a bunch of people were liking it and retweeting it. And I'm like, are you guys watching the show, or are you sitting down, pushing play, and just you're hate watching the entire time?
You're hate watching
to the point to where you're not allowing yourself to actually ingest everything the writers are putting into the episode, because this episode was the very
definition.
Thank you, Dave. The very definition of character development. Just to kind of bring it back to other Star Trek, let's bring up the sacred cows, right? Okay, let's talk about TNG, right?
Yes.
Miles O'Brien. Who the fuck was he for the first 5 years?
Pretty much.
And yet he was there all the time in the background. You didn't really know who he was.
No.
It wasn't until season three, with the introduction of the episode Wounded. We actually talked about it in a Patreon discussion.
Yeah, the Maquis.
It was the first introduction of the Cardassians.
Yes.
And they used O'Brien for the first time. It was season 4, episode 12. And mind you, he was in what, another 30 episodes before that? 20 episodes before that, he was a side player.
Yeah.
He was never the focus. It wasn't until season 4, episode 12, that we really learned something substantial about Miles O'Brien.
And then at that point, you could say that a lot of his character development didn't blossom until he was in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. And okay, let's double down, Dave. Worf. Who was Worf in the first season?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because at first he was just a security Klingon. That was it.
We knew nothing about him, really. It wasn't until after Tasha Yar died that they used that as a way to propel his story.
Yes.
And William Riker, number one. I mean, this might be something that infuriates some people, but I mean, we've joked about this before, Dave, and I'm going to be very careful how I say this because I love Riker. As a character,
too.
But let's be honest, he really didn't do much
exactly
until season 3. We broke this down. This is the best of both worlds. It wasn't until they started pushing his character in the direction of being a captain.
Yes.
Why are you still a commander? You could be so much more. And it wasn't until the episode The Best of Both Worlds in season 3. Yep. And a bled over to season 4 that we actually started getting some real development that was really interesting on Riker. For the first few years, yeah, we had our episodes here and there that were Riker-centric. But for the most part, Riker was that intimidating dude in the background that would yell and check out women.
He was the paper stereotype of Kirk.
In fact, we said that. That was one of the issues with the earlier seasons of TNG. It felt like they were trying to make Riker Captain Kirk 2.0.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until they figured out that wasn't working and they made him his own character, then that's when he became interesting.
Yeah.
So characters are slowly developed throughout the course of a show. You can't be 2 episodes into a season, 4 episodes into a season, and think you're going to understand everything about every character on that bridge. That's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen.
Unless you get a neat, snazzy, cheap, schlocky flashback, which is what so many people are accustomed to nowadays, is those flashbacks. And unfortunately, The Walking Dead and various other shows have made flashbacks popular again on TV. And honestly, to me, that is cheap gimmick writing. Because rather than getting to know a character through your immediate story, a linear story, they have to always revert to those flashbacks in order to make sure the audience understands why this person acts this way.
And that's why I like what how Kurtzman has approached a lot of Star Trek for this time, for this season two.
It's about where we met our characters and what they're doing
and what they're
now.
Doing now.
That's how we learn about these people.
Yeah.
It's David. When I met you, Dave, you were 26, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And we've known each other for many, many, many years now. Now, in order for me to get to know you, we worked together a lot. We went out to lunch. We went to dinners. We did film projects together. I didn't ask you to fill out a background form.
A bio.
Hey, David, you know what? I need to understand everything about you, Dave, in order for me to be your friend. So what I need you to do is I need you to go ahead and fill me in on your life from the time you were 5 all the way up to 25.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. That's what people seem to want with shows nowadays. And character development is a slow burn process.
Yes.
You slowly give audiences little tidbits to where eventually, suddenly, by season 3 or 4, we know exactly what type of person these characters are. It takes time.
Well, not only that, but I like the fact that he's not holding the audience's hand. You know, he's not saying, hey, come over here. This is how this happens.
There's nothing wrong taking your time. As long as the story is progressing, the immediate story is progressing, as long as we're not getting slow burn, you know, Walking Dead type writing, yeah, where nothing happens for 7 episodes and you're scratching your head wondering when the story's going to start to unfold. That's not the case. The story's moving forward. We feel like we're learning more about our characters each week. That's all we should really want from this show. We can't expect, yeah, us to fully understand every single character, you know, at the snap of a finger.
Yeah.
So people need to chill out and relax, Dave. And because, listen, if there was lack of character development, I would be the first one to say something. I'd be like, listen,
absolutely.
In fact, we said one of the big problems with last season is that we didn't really know our background players.
Uh-huh.
So give it time, right, Dave?
Give it time. I mean, you got to actually give it some time. Give it some time to breathe and grow. That's what
characters
do.
You got to let it air out, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. You know, let's go to a very quick break. And then when we get back, we're going to jump into all the ins and outs of this week's episode. There's a lot to talk about. We'll be right back.
Cry havoc! And let's slip the dogs of war.
Everything!
Have you missed an episode of DC on CW? If you have, this is what you've missed.
Yeah. Sure, son. And story over. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
And scene.
Fuck, we're going to need like 35 more minutes of cape shit.
Oh, boy. Wow. Would that have been a doozy of an episode? Tell you what. Why didn't they just do that?
Training montage, cape.
Now, try to get some bad guys down on the ground and throw them up into the air and knock someone out. Really good on the improv.
I am beyond impressed right now.
I know.
Good
damn.
Job.
Like,
good job.
Thanks, guys.
That would have been...
I don't even know what to do now. I feel like we're done.
But
I
think over.
Done.
Bye. Bye, guys.
Have a good night.
Mike, I got the next promo.
Don't miss DC on CW every week on Rain Man Digital, covering topics from Supergirl, The Flash, Arrow, and Legends of Tomorrow.
What are you looking at, nerd? Huh?
I thought I was looking at my mother's old douchebag, but that's in Ohio.
Geek Out Saturday.
And this is something that Supernatural, I don't think, has ever really had a big problem with.
Right.
All of its monsters, a lot of shows have procedural elements. We've talked about this before on the show.
There's a level of responsibility on his head as someone that is a metahuman and uses his powers for good.
She's force sensitive, but she's not a Jedi.
If you've been watching Rebels, you see that happen.
During a roundtable interview with reporters yesterday, The Flash executive producer Andrew Kreisberg revealed that Kevin Smith's...
However, race is important in the Dark Tower universe, and the relationship between Susanna Dean and Roland centers around the color of their skin.
Catch up on your favorite Rain Man digital geek shows every Saturday. DC on CW, Back to Tank, Weird West Radio, The Crossroads, and more. Geek out Saturday on Rain Man Channel 001. Listen for the Rain Man digital app or tune in. Just search RM Channel 001.
All right, hello everybody, welcome back to Star Trek From the Holodeck, the Discovery Edition. All right, Dave, let's jump right into this. Episode 4, directed by Lee Rose, written by Andrew Colvell and Alan B. McElroy. The synopsis: a mysterious sphere threatens the USS Discovery, even as May, in her original form, implements a plan that puts Tilly's life in danger. Saru and Burnham's bond grows when Saru is forced to acknowledge a deeply unsettling Kelpian truth. Pike receives new intel on Spock from a loyal, hot friend. I added that part. Can you tell? So, in the way of continuity fixes this week, let's start there.
Okay.
We learn why, and you had touched on this at the top of the show. Shame on you for jumping ahead. We learn why the Enterprise didn't have all that holographic technology.
Thank you.
And Dave, this is what we've been saying since day one. It's a very easy fix, guys. It's literally two or three words. And what did they do?
Two or three words.
That's it. But it did the trick. The Enterprise's systems were not working properly with the updated tech, so pull it all out.
And
done.
I like,
done.
Yeah. And I
and
loved
it works,
how,
Dave.
How
it works.
They made it part of Pike, because I enjoyed Pike actually turning to number one. It's like, it's kind of ghostly. It kind of creeps me out.
Yeah. you're right, Dave, because if, even though I feel like one or two lines would have worked, they strengthened that in previous episodes because they have already alluded to the fact that Pike's a guy that doesn't want to be bothered with all this nonsense.
Yeah.
So when he made that decision to just rip it all out, like, dude, that's fucking consistent with everything we've seen up to this point. So to people complaining about character development, that's development, because it's a believable decision for this character to make four episodes in.
Yes.
And this concept can theoretically be used to explain why we never saw this type of tech until TNG, with holograms in Deep Space Nine, with holographic communication. Obviously, there's still some issues to work out, but I'm thankful for the obvious direction they're taking to rectify some of these continuity issues.
Yeah, and they make it personal to that those characters, and that's what I really enjoy, is the fact that they made it personal to Pike, to the point that
yes,
it gives him character, not only for him, but for the Enterprise, the ship itself.
Right. It's giving him those little nuanced quirkiness, those yeah, quirky moments that a lot of our Star Trek characters have. And it just adds more realism to a portrayal, to a character portrayal, when they're not just, all right, I'm a captain and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Like, we have an understanding of what type of person he is, just based on the fact that he's not all into all this techno nonsense. I think it works. I also really dug number one. I mean, Rebecca Romijn's portrayal was great. Let's be honest, though, there's not really a lot to go on. Number one is a character that doesn't even have a name.
Yeah.
Was she ever given a name? She wasn't, right? She was always referred to as just number one.
Number one.
She's a character that was really only a part of the pilot that was actually canned by the network. But that doesn't mean fans since the 80s, when the pilot was finally realized in its entirety, didn't gravitate to the character. But most of that had to do with hopefully I'm pronouncing your name right, Majel Barrett Roddenberry's iconic status.
Yeah.
Because the pilot wasn't even something that was really a part of Star Trek canon until they made it a part of canon when they released it as an episode in the 80s.
Yes.
And now it's included and considered the first episode where you whenever you decide to stream Star Trek, whether it be Hulu, Amazon, or Netflix. So that being said, Robeco's remains had a pretty easy job. I think as long as they captured the things that we did know of her character, which was just a couple things. The only thing that I had really wanted was the obvious strong bond between the two, because in the pilot, that was the one thing that was very clear between the two of them.
Yes.
That there was a strong respect for each other. I mean,
like they,
number one, refused, even though all the evidence suggested that Captain Pike was dead. Like, he was taken captive. There's no way they're going to be able to rescue him, right?
Yeah.
Well, number one, refused to leave that planet. Refused. Yeah. She says, we don't leave anyone behind. We will not leave our captain behind. And there was it wasn't just a duty. It didn't come off as just, hey, I'm the second officer on this ship, and that's my duty to make sure we save the captain. There was real care behind her motivation. And for me, that's all I wanted to see. I wanted to make sure they capture that mutual respect for each other, and they did. They treated her less as a subordinate and more as a peer. The way they were talking was they were equals.
Yeah. And that's what I really enjoyed, was the fact that they really showed the fact that the way Pike views his crew is they have a very deep bond. The fact that basically number one looks at Captain Pike and says, tells him Spock is one of us. He's one of our family. We're not going to abandon him. And that harkens back to just like what you said. I mean, like, that gave me visions of number one refusing to leave Pike on that planet when everyone was saying, no, Pike's dead, we have to leave. And she literally stays there and says that, no, we're going to get him back.
Yeah. I really like that. And that's what I appreciated the most, because like I said, we don't really have much to go on with
not on the original crew.
Yeah, we don't. We don't have a lot to go on when it comes to number one. We don't have a lot to go on with Pike. So the little that is there, it needs to be cultivated, not retconned. And by cultivating it like they did in this episode, it just makes it feel more sincere to that pilot all those many years ago. There's another aspect of the whole peer aspect between the two of them, that they're equals. Because there was a comment that, I guess retrospectively from the pilot, can be considered misogynistic. But that comment was less about being misogynistic, and I'm talking about in the pilot. And it was less about being misogynistic and more, I think it was designed to show how Pike put number one on a pedestal. If you remember, there was a comment in the pilot where he was talking to a woman on the bridge and Pike felt uncomfortable. And he looked at number one and he said, I need to get used to women on the ship. I'm still trying to get used to women on board. That's what it was.
Yes.
I think it was less about being a douche and it was more about creating parallels to other naval traditions from Earth's past.
Yes.
The pilot, the show didn't have its legs yet. They weren't really sure in what direction they were going in. And so I don't think he was misogynistic. I just feel like they were trying to stress the fact that he views number one in a very different light. In fact, he even said that, oh, not you. Not you, number one. I don't look at you that way. He said that in the cage.
Yeah.
And that's what they needed to bring to the forefront in this episode. And it absolutely worked. I was satisfied with the intimacy of their conversation. There was trust, honesty, and again, possibly a friendship there as well.
Yeah.
And that's why I really dug what they did with her character, even though it was a very small moment.
And the thing was, it wasn't like an overblown, oh, this is a romance between the two characters.
No. Yeah, I don't think there's a romance. Yeah. I'm not saying intimacy in the fact that they're involved with each other sexually. I'm just saying there's an intimacy there. There's an understanding of each other. There is a closeness there. There's a bond.
There's a bond. Yeah. And the bond seemed very natural, like two friends actually talking to each other and saying, you know, this is what's going on. Hey, we got to work together on this. And it felt the biggest thing. It felt natural. Like, I could see this happening between two individuals.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Who plainly are best of friends.
Yeah.
And basically compatriots on the same crew. And that was the big thing, too, was the fact that they emphasized the fact that when Pike is with Number One, they are the Enterprise crew. They're not Discovery's crew. Pike will always be the captain of the Enterprise, and Number One's going to be always connected to the Enterprise. That's what I really dug with their conversation, was the fact that it started focusing on just them. It had nothing to do with Discovery. They didn't, you know, Number One wasn't talking about Discovery. She immediately was talking about the Enterprise and their crew.
Yeah.
And why she's here and why Spock is important to the Enterprise.
They found a great way to bring her in, because yes, it was not directly tied to the events going on in this episode, but it was connected to the myth arc because it had a lot to do with Spock. Because
it had to do with Spock.
As we said last week, I think we can all agree that Spock is the myth arc.
Yeah.
Spock, the Red Angel, and the signals. That's the myth arc, the mystery of all of that. So I also liked the Scotty Easter egg that I'm sure you picked up on. And I don't know, I guess you can call it an Easter egg. I would probably classify this as an Easter egg. When Pike says, I don't think there will ever be a person more in love with the Enterprise.
Yes.
I mean, obviously that was a wink, wink, right?
That was a wink, wink. Yeah. That felt like such a wink, wink.
I'm okay with fan service moments like that because it's fun. Like, it doesn't distract from the story. If you don't know the story of Scotty for whatever reason, let's say you're a new viewer, then you don't lose anything. These are the types of little fun moments you can do without derailing your current show.
That's what I thought narrative. Immediately when he says that, I'm going, he hasn't met Scotty.
That's awesome. All right, so let's move on. This episode, while keeping the momentum of the season going, was I think a good chosen path to take for this episode. Andrew Colville and Alan McElroy did manage to focus a lot on character development this week. That's why I laughed when I saw that guy complaining, who admittedly hate watches. You're not going to be able to see past your own fanboy tirades when you watch TV that way. That being said, Saru's story not only explained a lot about the Kelpian culture, but the events that transpired in the episode might also be the very thing that could get the entire General Order 1, a.k.a. the Prime Directive, out, as it may no longer pertain to the Kelpian species. That was the big takeaway. Based on the heavy implications from this week's episode, we get the idea that the Ba'ul is preventing the Kelpians from organically evolving as a species.
Yes.
And this changes everything depending on what happens next. I mean, we still don't know very much about the Ba'ul, but I can't imagine the Federation standing idly by when another advanced species is manipulating the culture of another species in such a way that they're preventing them from reaching their next stage in evolution.
Yeah, that would be the biggest.
I mean, can you see the Federation just standing by? Yeah, whatever.
That would be the biggest thing that basically I could see them using this case as a way of breaking the Prime Directive.
Yeah. So I'm assuming you interpreted it the same way, right?
Oh,
Dave?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Because it really brings into question, okay, we now know that there's a next chapter to Saru's
evolution. Yeah.
Which is going to be really interesting because there's going to be a lot of questions posed as, well, the Kelpians have always been a prey species. Now that we know that basically they evolved into a species.
Have they always been? I mean, this brings up a lot of questions.
Yeah.
This whole time, the Kelpians thought that the Vahari was a disease that would signal that their time has come to an end, that they're going to die. And this would be how they chose people to sacrifice to the Ba'ul. Now we find out that this is the moment they evolve into something entirely different.
Yes.
This is a major big issue with some serious implications. This is once again, in my opinion, because I love looking for these types of things in Star Trek shows, this once again has real world relevance. Prejudice has been the culprit for every similar thing that has happened within American society.
Yes.
Ignorant scientific discoveries. The role that eugenics, for example, played within American culture is disgusting.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the obvious being World War II and Nazi Germany. I'm talking about the progressive era of the late 19th and early 20th century, when eugenics was considered a method of preserving and improving the dominant groups in the population. It is now, of course, generally associated with racism, and
racism,
it should.
Yeah.
As you know, the movement was to some extent a reaction to the change in immigration from Europe rather than scientific genetics. You know, doctors would take it upon themselves to sterilize immigrants because of the fear that they would contaminate American ideals and the common held belief that immigrants were not as intelligent as some of the Anglos. So they would just, whenever someone would go in for a checkup, they would sterilize them, and sterilize they wouldn't even know.
Without even knowing.
And this goes for blacks. This goes for Mexicans. This goes for Native Americans. This goes for the Irish. And so I feel like they were definitely trying to draw some parallels to real world situations or yeah. What should I say? Real world instances where similar things have actually happened in our society that we're ashamed of. And I'm taking a few liberties with my interpretation, you know, due to us not having all the details, of course, yet.
Yes.
Behind what's happening with Saru. But the implications of a perverse, more advanced culture taking advantage is appalling, but highly intriguing.
Highly intriguing.
And I have some theories, Dave. Okay. I want you to back me up or throw something at me, okay?
Okay.
I'm assuming, again, we don't know much. I'm assuming the Ba'ul is also pre-warp. More advanced, yes, but also pre-warp. Otherwise, I think the Federation would have stepped in a long time ago. Imagine the Federation being aware, as we know they are, because of Georgiou's involvement from the Short Treks episode Brightest Star. I find it hard to believe the Federation would just stand by as a dominant species is literally altering the evolutionary path of a species. So I'm thinking if they were pre-warp, that's why they never interfered. I have a feeling it's going to be way more complicated, whatever ends up being. It's going to be way more complicated than just simply, oh, it's some bad guys that are, you know, taking advantage. If the Ba'ul's pre-warp, then the Prime Directive would still apply as well. That's why I feel like it's going to be complicated, because just because another species is doing something inhumane to another species doesn't mean that the Federation should interfere.
Interfere, because it still might be part of their culture.
Exactly.
And that's where I think it's going to get really interesting narrative-wise.
Yep.
Okay, is the Federation going to stick to their guns? And if the Ba'ul are pre-warp, this is all, you know, like still within their culture.
Yeah.
Stick to your guns and say, we can't interfere with this culture. Or this culture, the argument, just like what you were saying, is the argument is this culture is influencing this culture.
Right. And do you interfere if both species or cultures are pre-warp? See, dude, it's fucking fantastic, and it's going to pave the way for some great philosophical episodes. You know it's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. And this is Star Trek storytelling. This is atypical Star Trek storytelling that I always expect. And I'm really excited to see it, because a lot of people – I've been reading a lot of like what everyone thinks about this little situation that came up with Saru, and they're like going, well, it's easy. Yeah, we should interfere. We should do this because
– Should we though?
And yeah. I'm like going, I don't say that, you know, we shouldn't interfere when something horrific like that happens to a culture. We shouldn't interfere, but –
We don't know just what like our saying. Interference can do to any – for to both cultures. We don't know. I mean,
exactly.
That's kind of what the point – kind of the point of Stamets's own little personal story arc this episode was about we don't know what we do. We don't know what type of footprint we can put on an ecosystem when we interfere.
And look what happened with Stamets. Stamets doesn't know what he did wrong.
He does now. He kind of has an idea now, but he didn't.
But he didn't.
And that's why I feel like what's going to happen with Saru and the Kelpians is going to be far more complicated than simply, oh, look. we can go now break the Prime Directive. It's going to be a lot more complicated if
it, it's going to be
if you want take what they did this week with the parallel stories of both Stamets, Tilly, and Jet Reno, along with Saru and Burnham. Chances are they were strengthening the idea they were establishing with Saru's story.
And then the one interesting point in all of this that has me really intrigued where this where they could take this myth this story arc. Saru's changed as a character at this point. He does not have those ganglia to actually, he's not a creature that's built on the fear of being a prey.
At least that's kind of what they are hinting at.
That's
right?
What they were hinting at
the end of the episode. Yeah.
And you could tell, like, I give a lot of props to, Doug Jones.
Yeah.
He's able to actually act out. Without actually saying anything, he's actually able to show that Saru's completely changed. He's
body
not
language.
Afraid.
Well, that's what Doug Jones
language.
Does.
Yeah. And like it gave me chills when all of a sudden Saru just you see Saru for the first time ever. We see Saru angry.
Well, and his body language was just very different. That's a great thing to pick up on, Dave, because I think that was the biggest takeaway is that once his ganglii, whatever the gangly, what's it called?
Ganglii.
The ganglii, once that dropped from his skull, his body language changed. And I'm looking, I don't know what they're going to do with that, but I have some thoughts. And this may tie right back into, no, it does. It could very well tie right back into who the Ba'ul is and what their true connection is with the Kelpians. I have a feeling that it's connected a lot more than simply being two separate species. What if the Ba'ul are actually Kelpians as well?
Oh, that
same species, same species, just post ganglii, which has made them more of the aggressors. Talk about some fantastic character depth. If they show this through Saru, we have a guy that struggled because of the natural instinct of flight, you know, for survival. Saru being what he calls a prey species, but with the ganglii. What if they become, without the ganglii, what if they become more of an aggressor? After Saru's ganglii fell out, as you had said, he felt different. He even puffed out his chest. His body language changed. He was no longer a man that was governed by fears. He appeared more confident, more strong, very different. So that started to get my brain going. And I'm like, well, you know what? I'm wondering if the aggressive species known as the Ba'ul is essentially the Kelpians. And this could be an interesting move for Saru as a character. I mean, suddenly we have this character that must learn to balance out this newfound aggression. And the cool part about all of this, the part that I appreciate the most, the writers didn't pump the brakes on the rest of the story as well, Dave. No. Even though we got so much Saru and so much backstory on his species. But the way they paired Saru's personal narrative with the main story of the episode, which also pushed the overall story forward, was fantastic. There's so much going on in one episode. The way they paralleled the two was very good. It worked to tell a similar story when you think about it. The one sentient being coming to the end of his life, the Red Spear, right?
Yes.
While the other is approaching the next stage of evolution, but both struggling to hold on to their legacy. The Red Spear wanting to share its knowledge, and the other hoping to save his people. It's a form of cultural legacy. It works on so many different levels, and it creates a lot of questions, not bad questions. I'm talking those good questions that get your brain going, and you start getting really intrigued. Like, okay, what are they going to do with this? Who are the Ba'ul? What's going to happen to Saru now that he has no ganglii? Is he void of fear? Is he going to be something completely different now? Either way, the implications, Dave, that his evolution has been hindered, or an entire group has been hindered, their evolution, and they have been led to believe through ideology, religious, it's a form of religious ideology.
Yeah.
It's very ritualistic. Talk about the real world relevance in today's world yet again, Dave. The idea of an aggressor of some kind, an outside influence, manipulating an entire culture through ritualistic ideals and the idea of a higher power and that this is their place. This is what you should do. I mean, it's an atrocity. They allow the Kelpians to die before they can evolve into a more independent status, a point in their lives where they're no longer governed by fear.
That's why it was amazing seeing that parallel when Saru is utterly devoted to believing in his cultural beliefs, and he basically tells Burnham that he has to, in essence, euthanize him. She has to be the one to euthanize him, to cut off his ganglii and cause himself to die. And I was like going, then you flip it when he realizes, oh my God, that my entire culture, my entire belief was a lie. And you see the character change just automatically. Like suddenly it comes to like this eureka moment for the character. And it's like, it's heartbreaking, but it's also very awe-inspiring. So powerful. I mean, that scene with him and Burnham, I'll be honest, it got me a little teary-eyed watching it, because like, it's really hard for Burnham to do this, but she also understands, she's listening to Saru and saying, this is what my culture does. This is our beliefs.
But listen, Dave, never hand a woman a knife and say, cut off my ganglion. I mean, that's just going to end badly for everyone.
Badly. And that shows the bravery of Saru.
Exactly. We just went full circle with that discussion. That's character development.
Character development.
All right. So get more Star Trek from the holodeck each and every single month by pledging $5 or more to our Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/rainmandigital and pledge. And with that pledge, you will gain access to hours and hours of additional Star Trek discussions based on comics, themes, Star Trek philosophy, you name it, we do it. Patreon.com/RainmanDigital. All right, let's talk Tilly, Stamets, and Jet Reno and the team up that they ended up being this week. What a great trio of fun that was.
Yeah, it was.
I love to see the contrast between Gearhead, air quotes here, and scientists. Both highly intelligent with two different ways of getting shit done. It was fucking great. It was funny. It brought levity to a episode that was already drenched in a very grounded realism.
Yeah.
And was depressing at moments, and giving us this little bit here between Jet Reno and Stamets, I thought was a good call.
Yeah.
And most importantly, though, this bit, although it may appear to be just a distinctly different story and not necessarily connected, it did share a similar theme with Saru's side of things. And we had touched on that briefly a moment ago. For example, the contamination of culture.
Yes.
Because we find out that Stamets inadvertently started to contaminate the mycelial network. We still don't know the lengths of the damage that was caused, but we do know that it's not just bacteria and fungi any longer that resides there, but a sentient species that calls the mycelial dimension their home. We find out that May is a life form and part of a species called the Jossep.
Yep.
And this part of the episode was definitely championing the idea of being green. That's not a bad word, everyone. Calm down. We're not drawing lines in the sand and creating some political, you know, debate here. But it's the idea of green. I don't think anybody, whether you believe in a global warming or not, I mean, I think most people can agree that being green is better for the Earth, period.
Yes.
And people don't realize the massive footprint that mankind puts on the ecosystem. That was the point. Even when we are not aware of what we are doing, Stamets doubles down on the idea of the green aspect that was definitely tossed into this episode. Spores are clean. They're renewable. Stamets says, do you have any idea how many plants have been ruined by dilithium mining? Let's just replace that with fracking.
Fracking.
How battles were fought to corner its supply. Of course you don't. You're one of those people who never think about that, he says. So it was definitely a moment where they were firing shots. At the Industrial Revolution, at the use of fossil fuels. But at its heart, that argument is Star Trek.
Yes.
Is it not?
It is. Because like that's the whole point about like the question of bettering humanity. Is it actually worth it? what's the cost of bettering humanity? And that's why I like the fact that it with Stamets is going on and on to how, you know, 100 years ago, pollution surrounded the earth and everything. And he's talking about how great this technology is. But then when it gets turned on him and he realizes that, oh, shit, my own technology is destroying another person's world. It's like it like brought to the forefront of like, what were you willing to go? What lengths were you willing to go to better yourself? You're bettering yourself still. And
you never stop learning, right?
You never stop
evolving as a society. When you stop evolving, society becomes stale.
Stale, ignorant.
Yes, there's a lot of great points you can glean from this aspect of the episode. But outside of that, it did lead to some interesting narrative choices. What does May want with Tilly? Is this thing or species, is it nefarious or simply trying to fix what Stamets did? There are some clues we can derive from the title of the episode, Dave. The title itself comes from ancient Greek culture and refers to the coin. I think everybody's heard this story. The coin that was placed on or in the mouth, sometimes the eyes, depending on which story you're reading, of the newly deceased person as payment for Charon, the ferryman, essentially, who carried souls across the river that separated the world of the living from the world of the dead. Those are the key words you need to focus on there. The world of the living from the world of the dead.
Yep.
It is a suitable title. For example, we know that the mycelial network is the very idea of life. They've explained this numerous times now. Perhaps this mycelial network or highway is a bridge to the afterlife. Now, before you roll your eyes at me, David, Star Trek has played with this idea of an afterlife before. This isn't new.
Yeah.
I think they've actually delved into this idea in almost every Star Trek series. It, of course, being less spiritual, and I think it's more science-based, that's usually the direction they take Star Trek's world version of the afterlife. It's more of things we don't understand fully, and when we do, we realize it's not necessarily divine, it's more or less science. DS9 played with this notion through various episodes that dealt with the wormhole aliens. Voyager had an entire episode that was about a planet's rings and how when a species died, they discovered that essentially their life force / brain patterns meshed with the rings of the planet and became a part of it. And they realized that the entire rings were actually dead people's life force that were taken up to the rings of the planet. So this could be how they bring back Dr. Hugh Culbert when you think about it, or justify how Stamets feels his presence at the very least. The title could also be less of an allegory and more straightforward. Maybe the title was simply stating that life and death is a form of exploration and it comes with a cost. It could be different things, but I'm going to go with the other side of things, Dave. I think this is going to be the bridge to the afterlife, or at least a version of it, because we already know Hugh is alive. We already know. They've already said, I see him in the network.
Yes.
We already know that Stamets has said what? That life is eternal in that network. That essentially it is eternal.
It is eternal.
So are they playing with that? Is that the reason why they named the episode An Obel for Charon?
Honestly,
there's got to be a specific reason why they chose that title.
Yeah, honestly, I really think this is because it is a major...
You think it's a afterlife thing?
I think it is an afterlife thing because this is something that's still... Stamets as a character is still undefined. His myth arc is not finished yet.
His personal
story is not done yet. Because we saw that basically at the beginning of season 2, that was a major story point. Stamets is still at a loss about Hugh. And he's still obsessed with it. It still bothers him. He was still in grieving. And he needed some kind of drive to keep him going. I think that, yeah, this leads to Star Trek veering off into the question of the afterlife. which they've done in the past many, many times. They did some of the examples you gave. Also, you got to look at, you know, stuff about like the Klingons when they went into the Klingon quote unquote hell in TNG. They covered that stuff with I believe it was Worf's storyline. And so this isn't new ground, but it is something that I think this is where Stamets is going to go. They're going to cross the whole story of science versus religion with Stamets. It's his belief. Will his belief actually lead him to Hugh? Will his science lead him to Hugh?
Yeah. I think we're going in that direction. I think we might be spot on with this interpretation when it comes to Stamets, the mycelial network, what the species about, the Josh Shep. And the story of Dr. Hugh Culbert.
It's so Star Trek, because like Star Trek is really good at doing these types of stories where it's like showing that science has a cost. There's always a cost in science. Whether it's back in TNG when they did the whole storyline of how they showed how the warp drives were destroying the universe and creating all those dark black holes. This is the same way. I got the same vibe of this with when May looks at Stamets and says, "You're destroying my reality." And then Stamets comes to the realization that, oh shit, yeah, all my science and everything that I've worked on is essentially destroying another person's home. And while I was saying, I'm doing this for the benefit of me.
Yeah. I feel like it's all going in that direction.
I think it's going in that direction.
With the idea of the Red Angels and the Seven Signals and the theory I threw out last week of Seven Archangels. Again, I'm taking a lot of liberties here. But whether or not they're going to definitively state all of this, I don't think is not the point of my theory here. The point is that there are themes they're using to govern the story. Whether or not it ends up becoming, you know, realized in a tangibly written episode where we understand, oh, this is exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the point. If we see that, fine. But whether or not we see that isn't the point. The point is they're using these ideas to govern their story and to push it in a direction that they want to take the show.
In a lot of ways, we've kind of gotten this hint from watching season one, because remember, in season one, they were dealing with a lot of pseudoscience.
Yeah.
Tons of pseudoscience. This one, in season two, it really does feel that they're going to be taking that kind of dealing with pseudoscience, but instead, we're going to deal with it with science meeting religion. And what's the difference between the two? And I'm excited
for
it. Or to
see how they're all connected.
I love how Star Trek has always told storylines like this.
They've always connected the idea of religious faith with science. It's
all I gotta say is
they've always
done
it. Why
does God need a starship? and that movie by itself, while not a lot of people like it, we've stated, looking back, it was actually a really cool look into faith in Star Trek.
Yeah. For sure. All right, Dave, this actually brings us to the conclusion of this week's discussion of Star Trek Discovery. Why don't we end it with your final thoughts in a nutshell, 30 seconds or less. Go.
Okay. 30 seconds or less. This was a very strong episode. They continue to keep hitting it out of the park. I would give this a solid A. My favorite moments, acting wise and story wise, was the scene with Burnham and Saru on Saru's deathbed. That got me actually kind of getting the feels, the Star Trek feels. And honestly, my favorite moment, I think my favorite cinematic moment, like cinema wise, has to be the Tower of Babel moment when everyone's talking different languages and you see like the way they choose the shots, it's very chaotic and it goes along with the dialogue. It's brilliantly done. So overall, very good episodes. Season two is still on a roll. If you're not watching it, shame on you.
Yeah. Well, if they're not watching it, they're probably not listening to this discussion either, Dave.
You never know. A lot of people nowadays, they just want to don't want to watch it because they'll just hate on it.
They just want the highlights.
The highlights.
Yeah. All right, Dave, I will agree with you. This is definitely an A episode. Very strong moments of character development. Probably some of the best we've received in the entire run of Discovery to date.
Yeah.
Fantastically used character development as well. They used it as dual purpose. Not only was it a great way to learn more about our characters as they flesh out little tidbits behind Saru's background as a Kelpian, as a person, but also they're using it as a way to push a theme forward and to kind of keep the overall myth arc of the season consistent, tight and tight with ideas and thoughts that aren't just single serving. It's dual purpose. It's there to do what's necessary for an episode, but also there to propel the next episode,
yeah,
and even the season, and how everything is meshed together, even if it doesn't feel like it is or seem like it is. When you watch the episode, when you go back and analyze the episode with a fine tooth comb, you quickly realize that every moment of this episode was connected in some way, either by theme or foreshadowing. And so it worked. It worked for me in a very big way.
And if I can add one last thing. The one thing that I really liked about it was they were able to take Saru's story, his whole story arc, this whole episode, and still tie it to Burnham and influence Burnham's story.
Yep.
They continued Burnham's story,
which is what they should always do, and they have. I agree, Dave. Thank you for that bit, because I did forget that. You're absolutely right. This is Burnham's story. This is Burnham's story, and despite the fact that they're finding nice room for the growth of our other characters, at the same time, we have to remember the core concept of the show, and it's a show about Burnham.
Yeah.
And what better way to tell a story than find creative ways to develop our background players and push forward the narrative of our main players,
yep,
at the same time. All right. So this concludes our discussion. I want to thank everybody for listening. If you miss any part of this broadcast, you can always find us on Google Play, Spotify, iTunes, and Stitcher. Just search Star Trek From the Holodeck. Also, patreon.com/RainmanDigital. Pledge $5 or more a month and gain access to hundreds of hours of additional Star Trek discussions. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.